The session today will be World Hunger, Polar Understandings. I think that this session is going to tie some things together that we discussed in the first two sessions. Whether or not you were here in the first two sessions won't make a great deal of difference, but those of you who are may be able to refer back to those first two sessions and find out how the first three sessions are related. What we're really doing is a case study of a specific problem of poverty, that being hunger. And sometimes it's helpful to zero in on one issue rather than to talk about a term that's so large, a term like poverty. The way in which the poor and the rich countries trade is part of this problem. Also, the views that people have as to why the third world is poor is also part of the problem. I'm not so sure I would have picked this topic for Holden if I hadn't just attended a conference of the National Council of Churches. It was held for 4 days, and they brought together people from all over the United States. Each denomination, I believe there were 10 or 12 denominations present, each denomination had a delegation, 10 members. And of those 10 members, they tried to pick about three from the church headquarters, someone that was working in world hunger or global justice, and someone from a seminary, and a lay person. And then the other six or seven tended to come from universities and colleges. Supposedly they were bringing the experts in who work with world hunger. Well, I thought, I'm sure some of you here have batted the issue of world hunger around, 30, 40 years more than I have. And so, and now that I've done it for about 10 years, it seems like it's an old theme, and here we go again one more time. And I probably wouldn't have, selected this topic, except that I felt that conference was very informative. In that conference, or during that conference, we had what I thought were some experts there, and certainly they are considered experts by people around the world. But we all came from a Christian perspective. That was the one common ingredient. We were all members of a church. We all professed the Christian religion. And I thought, boy, this is going to be fun. We're going to have people from the church, the people from the universities who work on food production. We're going to get together, and maybe something good will come out of it. What happened was that we ended up with some polar understandings. We had one group that said, I see the world hunger problem as this, and it was an extreme case. And we had people on the other side who said, I see the world hunger problem in these terms. And I thought, fine, we've got the two polar views coming out. Now, we're Christians. Let's start working to the middle, or let's start listening to each other and see what we can learn from the other side, and maybe something positive will come out of this. So after the first day, I was pretty excited. I was certainly hearing two stories, but what happened at that session was that the polarized views became even more polarized. And by the third or fourth day, we were almost, it's kind of embarrassing to say this, but almost yelling at each other. And every time somebody took a shot at my polar view or at the other polar view, let's say, everybody became so defensive. See, we're all specialists. And so that was somebody taking on your profession. You may have worked there for years. And as far as I was concerned, no one was listening. Everybody was talking. I'll give you an example. After each presentation, we had ample opportunity, at least a half hour to 45 minutes, for people to get up and ask questions. And I started counting, and I lost track. But it was something out of, say, the 60 people who went to the microphone, at least 50 went to make a statement. And I don't even remember 10 questions being asked. I say that because I think it was like two or three questions that I even remember, but I don't want to over-exaggerate. People went to make statements because they wanted to support their polar view. And nobody asked the question, now you say this and we say this, or what do you mean? Is there anything that we can learn from each other to try and solve the problem? So I guess what I want to do today is I hope I'm correct here, I don't want to say too much today. I've been talking way too much, and I don't think that's the main intention of Holden, and yet you try to get some background to work with so that you can discuss some of the issues and feel a little more comfortable about what you're saying and where you're coming from. But I want to ask some of the old questions, and I guess I would like to hear some of your views, and you don't have to be afraid about being right or wrong, or being, because you couldn't become any more polarized than we were there, so that won't, you shouldn't worry about that. But I would just like to hear some of your views. I honestly think that, I don't know how sincere I am about this, but I'm beginning to think that leaving these kind of problems to the experts, I've said this before, is pretty dangerous, because we are so specialized and we have to defend our own profession. And it's probably if the problem's going to get solved by clear-thinking people who are willing to listen and then make some decisions, it'll be groups like the group here that's meeting today. I suspicion there are some people in this group, I know a few in particular, who have worked a great deal with the hunger problem. And so I don't want to really dominate this session any more than need be by just rambling on. So I'm going to ask a few questions. First is, why do you think hunger continues to be the problem, a problem, and the statistics are like 800 million people who suffer from some form of hunger? Now, it's difficult to, you have to really be able to define what hunger is, and I'm not an expert in that area, but whether it means lack of protein or what, there are many different ways to define that. But in the general definition, about 800 million people who are not getting a sufficient diet, do not have sufficient diet. To be fully human, to develop normally, both mentally and physically. I mean, this isn't a small problem we're talking about, 800 million. What, then, is the problem? And I guess I would like to open the floor up now. I think, as I've done in the past, after I hear some of the points of view, I would like to make as clear as possible these polarized understandings, the two extremes, and characterize what they are. Just so that we have some summary statement here. And I guess I also would like to have a few minutes at the end to say something about the solution as I see it. And what I will be doing more than anything else is cautioning you not to become too terribly extreme by the time we end. I mean, let's listen to both sides. Let's see what's going on. There must be some truth. I mean, I can't believe that the two sides could be so vocal and both sides be 100% wrong. I mean, that's just, I just don't think that's correct. So, question is, why does hunger continue? 800 million people who suffer from some form of hunger, why does that continue? And what do you think we should do about that? What are some solutions? Jim McGinnis, I'll be referring to Jim McGinnis several times today, really does a good job because his whole book is on the hunger problem. It's called Bread and Justice. If there's anything wrong with the title, it's that it gives you the impression that it is a book only on hunger. And it's on far more than hunger. It's really a good book. And he tries to tie the issue of justice to the whole hunger problem. And I will put his framework on the board a little bit later when it comes to looking to solutions. What is justice and how do you try to solve the hunger problem within his justice framework? What are some important ingredients? So I will be coming back to that. But for now, I'll just open the floor and let you speak your piece and counter those arguments. And then maybe after we look at the problem, we can talk a little bit about solutions. Okay.
You know, we've certainly been made aware recently in East Africa, isn't it, where the desert is encroaching on what once were grazing lands, and so a whole way of life is being dislocated, and also the refugee problems and due to wars and so on in that part of the world that have deprived people of their way of making a livelihood.
Are you saying then that one of the root causes is weather and what it is doing?
Well, it's not really weather, is it? It's overgrazing of the lands that formerly produced grass, and the people used to be nomadic, isn't it? I'm not real clear on it, but and then they now live in one place, and so the lands get overgrazed, and the desert takes over.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But then also the refugee problem is another.
Okay, yeah. You know, when we talked about the hunger problem during those 4 days, the refugee problem never came up as an element of it until the last day. And finally someone stood up and said, the refugee situation is very serious and it has to be addressed within this whole context.
Displaced people for what?
Yeah, right. That's what they have in common, isn't it? They're both displaced.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Overpopulation of that area.
The fact that a small percentage of the people are using a large percentage of the like grains and things like that.
Well, you're talking about, I don't know if you'd call it the food chain, but how you use grains to make meat.
And yeah, and a small portion are using a lot more than they should.
I think he's talking about distribution.
Of food resources. Yes.
Can empathy be considered?
Yeah, it can always be considered.
Because I've really never been hungry for a week in my life. Or even a couple of days. So what do I really need for my gut really hurt because I was hairy? It's so far removed from my personal experience.
Yeah, empathy on the part of people who are not hungry.
Put that up in the north. People live in the north. Yes.
That a lot of the southern countries are raising food that sells on the world market that the north will buy. And so that a lot of the food is exported from the poor countries, and a lot of the food that they grow isn't the kind of food that their people need. You know, they grow things like coffee beans or something and not rice or something that the people can eat.
Okay, you mentioned a lot of things. Type of food produced, the whole export market. And if I take the food produced, is it basic necessities, are the staples, or is it cotton, coffee beans, cocoa?
Turn off coffee beans around here and see how long you think it's not a necessity.
Can I just speak from my own point of view?
I can't stand it.
How about priorities of the government and as far as military spending instead of feeding the poor?
You're talking a lot about the economic oppression, the systems, economics that oppress the poor people.
Okay, and those systems, the world system and the internal system within the country?
Political system.
Yeah. Going along with that system bit, if our government ordered enough grain to give away and feed half the world, it would drive our wheat prices up to where our people wouldn't stand for it.
Yeah. And what would happen when the other countries receive that grain? You know what happened to their market?
Yeah.
Just as our supply falls, their supply goes up. You know, push the price of their grains down, and it'll mean the local producers will have very little incentive to produce. I mean, you heard both sides on that one.
Only the people that handle it coming and going make them
up. Yeah, the people in the middle will come out at winners.
So what's the solution?
Really for the solution.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. One reason, the cause I heard was a lack of local leadership in some areas for people to teach agricultural things in their area. Or sometimes people being educated in the north, going and learning agricultural skills for the land we have here, and then going back to the jungle or something, and almost misusing the land so that it destroys the land. So you have
transplanting inappropriate technology.
Yeah, that's what it is.
terms of apathy, in order to handle a problem, one has to will to deal with it and to implement some type of program. And oftentimes we choose not to will to handle it.
Okay, political will on the part of the people, is that what you're getting at? Yes.
I think the kind of help is important, and I'm thinking basically of the self-help type program, and probably the lack of such programs, short and sudden.
Tomorrow, because I always like to get plug-ins for the next session, I'm going to say, what can the church do, or what really can we as Christians do? And I'm going to really pick up on what I think is the appropriate type of response from the way I see it. Now, you can all throw in your solutions or advice to tomorrow, certainly. And that is one thing I'll really stress, the type of assistance that comes.
I think in some cultures, or many cultures where there is a hunger, there's also some level of acceptance of that by the people, as that's the way it's always been. We in the North tend to have the mentality of trying to overcome something. Like, for example, yesterday of inventing air conditioning because it's hot. And I still believe that many of those people, if your culture is to be a Bedouin in the desert, thinking about preparing for tomorrow, or tomorrow being any different than yesterday or the last 10 million days, is maybe something foreign to you. Thinking of trying to improve, doing something today to make tomorrow any different than yesterday was. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a different concept to us.
Schumacher refers to that, I think, as just discipline and attitudes, and how important they are to, as an assumption to wherever it is you're going. Yes? Well,
certainly leadership in many of the countries that are hungry is important, in that it isn't the best kind of leadership. Political problems cause a lot of the problems of distribution of food and lack of maximum use of the resources. I read an article about Zaire, I believe, once, where they used to be a food exporting nation, I believe. Anyway, it's a very productive, they have very productive agricultural land, and now everything has gone down the tubes. The highway system is virtually non-existent. The peasant farmers are getting virtually nothing for what they produce, and it's a very bad situation. And it once was much better, but due to the political system in that country, I think it's worse than it should be.
Leadership tends to be self-perpetuating rather than serving of the populace. Mm-hmm. Spend your time staying in power.
Yeah.
One pervasive type of thing that I see is the lack of a global consciousness. We've talked a lot about that. And we think of the South as being a nice topic for National Geographic, but nothing more, in that it's something totally detached from us. But a global consciousness, what we see, is we're all part of the same system.
Yeah. Maybe I'll comment on that now, because whenever I have the opportunity, I like to bring up something on the book by Matthew Fox, and I don't know, I've been doing that so much that some of you have heard that I know many times, but Matthew Fox talks about the fact that if we are going to survive as a world, we're going to have to develop some sense of compassion. And compassion, the way in which he defines it, is pretty elaborate, but it is a global consciousness. It's one where you try to understand how other people feel, what their problems are, and you become involved and become active in trying to bring about change. And even, I have to say this because pretty much of the group here is different from last week, but when someone said apathy and the fact that we don't care, I just as an economist cannot pass up the opportunity to say something about Adam Smith. Adam Smith was an economist who wrote his important book in 1776, when we had our bicentennial. The economists all celebrated Adam Smith's 200th birthday also because of his book, Wealth of Nations. And we often see in capitalism that, well, everything will take care of itself through the market system. But Adam Smith said that if you don't build that capitalistic system on a base that emphasizes a very high level of moral development, and he called it sympathy, See, Adam Smith was a moral philosopher. He wasn't an economist. We didn't even have economists then. He was a moral philosopher. He said, if you don't have sympathy, and by sympathy he means you can put yourself in the shoes of another person and know how they feel because of your actions, or just to know how they're feeling. If you cannot do that, capitalism, the system of capitalism is going to create, could create some very serious problems for a lot of people. And so when you say we're apathetic, we don't, and Fox says, we don't have a sense of compassion. I don't like to zero in on one factor. In fact, I almost stood up at that meeting and wanted to push my own side, the Matthew Fox side, where's the compassion in this whole meeting? Is anybody listening to anybody else? Is anybody caring about what's going on? And without that element, I mean, I think a lot of what we're going to say today won't go very far. And Adam Smith would have said the same thing. Without that high level of moral development, that he may not have said global consciousness in those days, because I'm not sure how important it was. It was the wealth of nations, the wealth of his nation. Terribly important. Well, does anybody else want to say something before I try to put these in two categories? Yes.
Sometimes the cultural traditions prevent people from accepting new ideas. Men can't do women's work.
Or don't even sit in cow.
That's India's problem.
The sacred cow is interesting in that.
I mean, sacred cow, not necessarily just the cow bovine, but the generality.
Right.
Okay. When a new, like in healthcare, comes in, like it did quite a few years ago, to improve health and clean up the cisterns and that sort of thing, and lower the infant mortality, that was one of the reasons for the increase in overpopulation, along with some of the old ideas that you've got to have a lot of kids to have Social Security in later life. I mean, that stayed with it, but they still had to have a lot of kids. So.
Does anybody care if I do a little 5-minute aside on population?
What is there the world population?
Pardon?
You know what the world population is?
Well, I know we're. Did we just go over 4 billion or are we pushing 4 billion?
No, we're over 4 billion.
It wasn't too many months ago, I think, that we went over 4 billion.
In other words, 1/5 of the world is hungry.
Yeah, that's right. That's a good point. There was an international conference in Budapest on world population. I think it was 1974. And what came out of that was the North all said, the problem is overpopulation, you have too many people, and most of the people living in the South said the problem isn't that, it's that you overconsume in the North. And they never did get much further than that, because they took two such different points of view. And once again, an inability or at least an unwillingness to listen to the two sides. My personal view on it is that population is certainly a problem. When population grows, you just have more people to feed. I don't see how you can deny that. And whether or not a country has the resources for a greater or larger population isn't the issue. In the future, it's right now, given the resources, the way they're distributed and who and how much is available, you do have to look at your population. So I've never been willing to go so far as to say that population is not an issue. But population, the problem, well, it's a chicken and egg question. Does high population prevent people from being fed, or does it, let me see, how do I want to say this? Does the fact that you have high population mean the country cannot develop, or is the problem that because the country can't develop and is poor, you have high population? Yeah. And, you know, we just bat that around a long time. And most people feel that the way you're going to solve the population problem is by development. That the route you go is to help improve the level of living, and population will solve itself. And so I want to give you an argument for that. Economists, one of our great tools that we have at our disposal, we think at least, is what we call benefit-cost analysis. And so I hate to make family size a benefit-cost study, but I'm going to do that. If you take the benefits and the costs of raising children. Okay, in the United States, the benefits of raising children are, do they work for you? Sometimes you do a little work. when they go out and earn money mowing lawns and paper routes and whatever, do they bring the money home for the family? Not really. It's very often. They don't throw it in the kitty for everybody to spend. When you're older, is that a form of social security, having younger children? We're such a mobile society, and we value privacy so much. It isn't very often that it's social security. Help me with some benefits now. What are some benefits that you can measure in dollar terms, even if you had to fudge a little bit to put dollar terms on it? I think there's a satisfaction of a family, just the joy of having a family, which is worth something, certainly.
Dollar terms?
I mean, if I could put a dollar term on it, I mean, I go to a movie and I put a dollar term on that, being able to play with the kids or do some things, I could put a dollar term on it. It'd be hard. I mean, there's no market to tell you if I'm telling you the truth or not, but I could put some value on it. What are the benefits of children? I mean, I know there are benefits, but what are they?
In dollars. You can save a little bit on your income tax.
Okay, there's one. You get some income tax breaks.
How about it looks more cost to raise a child?
Okay, we'll go to the other side. I always told students for several years that the cost of raising one child, putting that child through a college education, was about, in other words, to age 22, including the college education, was between $80,000 and $85,000. The other day, or a couple months ago, Sonia, my wife, showed me an article in, what was that, Family Magazine, whatever, that the cost is over $200,000 now. I can't believe that. But when you weigh those two sides, when you get into a highly developed country, or to buy food, to buy clothing, entertainment, and if they want to play sports, you got to buy $40 shoes for them, and education and all of this. The costs are high. I don't see how I could ever spend that much on my kids. But I don't know. Maybe if you divide it up, I would end up doing that. Now let's go to a poor country and do that same analysis, benefit and costs. What are the costs of raising another child? Okay, mostly it's hand-me-down clothes. I mean, there won't be much of an investment in clothing. Food. Not a great amount of additional food is needed for them. Certainly you need it, but it's not very expensive. If you're self-sufficient, it won't be very costly. Few go to school through college, and those that do go to school will probably go to some government program, so the government will pay for it. What are the real costs? I mean, there just aren't very many in that setting. What are the benefits? They will work, especially on the farm, or if you're living in the city, those kids go to work in the morning. And they'll look for bottles or whatever that they can resell, or papers, or they'll stand on corners and try and sell goods when cars go by, magazines, whatever. And that money will be contributed to the family. In old age, you will probably be taken care of by your children because there is no social security system. One of the first things that Mao did to handle, try and solve a population problem was come up with a fairly good social security system to take the pressure off of having children because of old age, because of what you do in older age. But you see how the benefits there tend to really outweigh costs. And if you think you're going to solve population problems just by telling someone that you don't, your population is too high, they look. Oh, and that's. Oh, by the way, the one I really forgot is when you don't have much money, you don't do the same kinds of things we do for entertainment. Go to movies and cultural events and orchestra and all of this. Your family is essential to your entertainment. I mean, families. It's terribly important to have family and to do, and they do things as family. That doesn't mean that they're all wonderfully happy and they don't have problems and squabbles and all of that. But the family's important. The benefits just outweigh the costs. And so when you get into population, it is kind of tough to really simply say, well, now look, if you only had two children, maybe it would be easier for the country to develop. It's not a very clear argument to the individual. It's really a tough one to work with. Well,
doesn't China limit the families to two now? They're trying to?
I don't. Somebody else say anything about China? I know the goals they have too, and I've even heard that they want to try to push it down to one. But I don't think they do it by force and coercion. It's more or less peer pressure, and the right thing to do is to have two. But it's not like India where they tried forced sterilization, and that did not last very long at all. Yes?
I think in one Latin American country in particular, they consider themselves underpopulated because because they look at all the empty space
that's
around and say, look, we don't have anybody living out there. And we need to fill that up with people. Yet there are thousands of, millions of people in the country who are living in subsistence and poverty.
Yeah. The resources may be there, but the level of, in which they've been able to develop does not support the people right now.
It's an attitude.